And God said, let the waters bring forth abundantly the moving creature that hath life, and fowl that may fly above the earth in the open firmament of heaven. God created great whales and every living creature that moveth, which the waters brought forth abundantly after their kind, and every winged fowl after his kind. And God saw that it was good. And God blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply, and fill the waters in the seas, and let fowl multiply in the earth. Evening and the morning. Look at this day. Today we're going to look at fish and creatures of the sea. Everywhere you look in this world, you find evidence of a master designer, a master creator. You go to the desert, the evidence is there. You go to the mountains, the evidence is there. You go to the valleys and the forests, the plains, the swamp, the ice caps, the evidence is all around you. You go into outer space and the evidence is staggering, overwhelming. Go beneath the surface of the water, in lakes and streams and oceans, and you will find irrefutable evidence for creation and against evolution. Consider the deep sea anglerfish. You can find this fish 6,000 feet beneath the surface of the sea. At 6,000 feet below the surface of the ocean, it's pitch black at high noon. It's always night down there. The deep sea anglerfish has a 6-inch long projection growing from her head. It's like a fishing pole. Only she doesn't use worms or a lure to attract other fish. She uses a light. On the end of that 6-inch little appendage is a little orange light. And that light attracts other fish and other sea animals. God has given a light to many animals and creatures that live in the dark regions of the ocean. It is said there are some fish, when they gather in swarms way down beneath the surface of the ocean, it can almost look as if the ocean is on fire. There is so much light generated by all the different fish there. When a hungry fish sees that little orange light wriggling around on the top of the head of the deep sea angler fish, it figures it can go get dinner. Instead, it is the dinner. So when the fish comes over to swallow up the orange light, the angler fish swallows it up instead. The angler fish is about 3.5 feet long with rough black skin. The fishing rod grows just over her top lip. She can move it anywhere she likes. When another fish shows interest, she simply moves it near her mouth, and the dinner-to-be swims right where the anglerfish can catch it without any trouble. The deep-sea anglerfish isn't hungry. She folds the fishing rod back into a specially designed groove on the top of her head and turns her light off. You think I'm making any of this up? You can go to the library and study it for yourself. Some of you are sitting out there thinking, I wonder if that's really true. And then you leave here and buy the National Enquirer at the grocery store on your way home. By the way, in case you haven't read, Hillary Clinton is pregnant. I saw that at the grocery store the other day, just so you'll know. But seriously, the anglerfish's light works by oxygen. She doesn't need batteries. She doesn't need a light bulb. She has a piece of luciferin at the end of her fishing rod. Luciferin is a chemical that lights up when it comes in contact with oxygen. And when the anglerfish wants to turn her light on, she lets the blood flow to luciferin. There's oxygen in her blood, and that turns the light on. She turns the light off by stopping the blood from flowing to her little appendage there. She gets her oxygen out of the water she lives in. Her gills absorb the oxygen, and it flows into her bloodstream, and that's all she needs to turn her light on. By the way, lightning bulbs have luciferin in their tails, and lightning bugs turn their lights on in a similar way. You may have noticed that I have referred to the deep sea anglerfish in the feminine gender. Alas, the male is not quite as spectacular. He has no luciferin. In fact, he's only about 1/7 the size of his wife. Early on in their lives, when the two fish meet, he swims up to her left side and sinks his teeth into her. He never lets go, and soon their skin and blood vessels grow together. You know, she's thinking, I should have eaten him. I knew I should have eaten him. He swam up. But by now, the two have mated for life, and Mr. Anglerfish lives off his wife. He becomes a parasite. I'm trying to resist the urge to stay here for a while and draw some analogies, but I think I better just move on. Ladies, if your husband doesn't seem too anxious to look for a job, just call him Mr. Anglerfish, and maybe he'll get the message. Now, when the baby anglerfish come out of the fertilized eggs that are laid, they won't have 6-inch long fishing rods to attract fish to them, so how can they eat? In fact, they're only 1/8 of an inch long. How could they possibly survive in a deep, dark ocean and no means to attract food? The eggs that are laid float slowly to the surface of the ocean 6,000 feet above as they are developing. Then the young fish live at the surface of the ocean and feed on tiny sea creatures there. The reason the baby fish can float is because they have a tiny layer of lighter-than-water jelly under their skin. And as that baby fish grows, it gradually loses that jelly and slowly starts to sink. As it gets older, down, down, down it will go, some 6,000 feet itself. Now the trout, the bass, and fish like that all have an air-filled swim bladder that would literally implode way before those fish could get to 6,000 feet. The surface of the ocean, the pressure is 14.7 pounds per square inch. For every 33 feet that a fish swims down into the ocean, the pressure increases by another 14.7 pounds per square inch. At 6,000 feet below the surface of the ocean, the pressure on a fish is 2,672 pounds per square inch, more than a ton per square inch of pressure. The deep-sea anglerfish does not have a swim bladder. There's no air sac to burst in his body, especially designed to live down there. Now, do you think that the deep-sea anglerfish just evolved? How did it develop the luciferin? How could it know to do that? And how did it eat before it developed it? How did it know to provide for its young by getting them to the surface? And how could it have just willed to do that even if it knew that it needed to? Consider something completely different than the anglerfish, the barnacle. I realize it's not a fish. These little creatures don't swim. Their stems are glued fast for life to the bottoms of boats and wooden piers and to rocks, also sometimes to whales and giant sea turtles. How does a barnacle fasten itself to a ship or to a turtle? In its head is a little glue factory. It produces a sticky, powerful glue. It's a protein cement called amphipodin. Scientists have said it may be the strongest glue in the world. It even sticks to wet objects. You try to glue two wet things together sometime, you probably won't be too successful. The barnacle cement works so well even underwater that it fastens himself for life to whatever he attaches himself to. You know, glue factories are designed and built by intelligent people. Scientists and other highly educated, highly trained, highly skilled people work on formulas until they have it just right. To think that a glue factory evolved would be foolish. Barnacle factory is a billion times smaller, and yet his glue is 10 times better. Who designed his little factory? Obviously, someone much greater than man. How does a barnacle eat? They tell us that a barnacle can smell food floating around him. They'll open their shells and push out 24 long, thick, slender fingers called cirri. These wiggle back and forth in the water and grab anything that's edible. Coil around it and quickly pull it back inside, and then instantly the shell snaps shut. Some barnacles glue themselves to big rocks near the shoreline. When the tide is in, those rocks are covered. When it's out, the barnacles are not underwater. Yet a barnacle must live underwater or it will die. So what happens when the tide goes out? The barnacle somehow knows to fill his shell with water before the tide goes out. A very important muscle on the barnacle pulls the shell tightly together, making it leak-proof and watertight, and that way his gills can take oxygen out of the water and he will stay alive and the sun can't dry him out either. How does he know to do that? Evolution? Not a chance. How about the eel? There's a certain kind of eel that is born way down deep in the Caribbean Sea. The mother and father eels go there from Canada, from the United States, from Norway, from Sweden, from France, from Africa, literally from countries all around the world. After the babies are born, the parents go back home and leave them there. At birth, the babies are tiny, little, thin, wispy things, but they eat constantly and they grow rapidly. Though the eels are born in salt water, they love to live in fresh water. When they are big enough, they start for home. They return to the lakes and the rivers and the countries that their parents came from. There is no one to show them the way. There are no maps or compasses or guideposts. Their parents have been gone a long time. But if their parents came from Canada, the offspring don't go to Sweden, they go to Canada. If their parents came from the United States, the offspring don't go to Norway, they go to the United States. Scientists can't explain why, but I can. God made them that way. The Bible says the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. There are so many things in nature and in our lives that scientists can't account for, and evolutionists have no idea. Because they'd ruled out the very existence of a creator God, who in his wisdom gave the wisdom necessary to his creatures to survive. Consider the whale. I know the whale is a mammal. And some of you are thinking, how come you didn't preach on the whale when you preached about mammals? Because I didn't want to. Whales are able to stay underwater for a long time, but they have no gills. They must breathe atmospheric air as do other members of the mammal family. In order for the whale to be able to descend to the ocean's depths, remain there for a long time, it has a very large reservoir of arterial blood which receives oxygen during the spoutings and is kept in reserve for use by the four-chambered heart that the whale has. The whale also has a very large lung capacity. When it runs out of air, the whale must rise to the surface or it will drown. Now, if evolution were true, the whale should have developed gills somewhere along the way. But no, God didn't design them that way. The baby whale, when it is born, is immediately able to accompany its mother in her journey through the ocean. If it was otherwise, it would put whales at great risk. The skin of the whale is hairless, and underneath is a large layer of fat, sometimes nearly 2 feet in thickness. Very elastic and providing warmth and resistance to the enormous pressures of the water when the whale is deeply submerged. At 4,000 or 5,000 feet beneath the surface of the ocean, the aggregate total pressure on the whale's body is some 400 million pounds, or 200,000 tons of pressure, depending on the size of the whale and how deep it is. A large whale's the spinal column, they tell us, is like the trunk of a good-sized tree. The individual vertebrae are massive blocks bound together by the toughest ligaments and cartilages. The main artery is a pipe large enough to easily hold a full-grown man. The heart is a huge machine of incredible power and capacity, pumping out literally gallons of blood with every pulsation. Its mouth is huge, its tongue large enough for 6 men to lie down on. Its tail is massive and powerful, able to smash a boat to splinters with one blow. Most remarkable feature of the mouth on certain types of whales is what's called the baleen. Several hundred strips of flesh hang down from each side of the upper jaw. These strips vary in size according to where they are located, but the longest are some 10 to 12 feet long, nearly a foot wide at the base, and splitting into a multitude of hair-like fringes at the end. On a large whale, the baleen can weigh as much as 1 ton. Now, in feeding, the whale swims along with its mouth wide open, engulfing millions of tiny sea creatures, small shrimps and mollusks, fish and crabs, etc. When the mouth is filled with this mass of living creatures, the tongue is raised. The tongue can weigh up to 2 tons on a large whale. It's raised, leaving the water strained out through the baleen fringes, leaving a mass of food to travel down the gullet. The whale must consume large amounts, large masses of small fish, because the gullet is so small that even the largest whale in the world cannot swallow a good-sized herring, and yet God has made provision for its survival. Humpback whales are some 40 feet in long and weigh approximately 40 tons. Each of these whales sing a song that can be heard more than 50 miles away underwater, and every one of these whales sing the exact same song. Scientists tell us that each year the song of the humpback whale changes slightly, and every humpback whale in the world will still sing that year's song, will change its song, sing the new year's song. There's a remarkable variety in all of creation. How about the dolphin? Remarkable creature. There are some 20 different species of dolphins. The brain of a dolphin, they tell us, is quite large. Scientists believe that a big part of the brain is used to interpret the ultrasonic signals used to communicate with each other. Sent underwater, sometimes as many as 500 clicks to the second. The brain then analyzes the signals and translates them. The Reader's Digest reported on 3 trained dolphins that escaped from their performing pen at a resort in Key Largo, Florida. They were discovered several days later in the lagoon off Key Biscayne, some 55 miles away. They said at 10 a.m., 2 p.m., and 4 p.m., they were still out there performing tricks, apparently hoping to be fed on their Key Largo show schedule. Dolphins are highly intelligent, very social, and easy to train. They are not, however, anywhere near as intelligent as man, as some animal rights activists would have you believe. No animal is. The evolutionist points to some experiments with chimpanzees or apes where they have learned to recognize and associate certain pictures or symbols as evidence of evolution. They would have us believe that the chimpanzee is almost as intelligent as man. It's not even close. If you think animals are close to us in intelligence, Try to teach geometry to your cat or algebra to your bird, or theology to your dog or astronomy to a dolphin. Show me an animal that can design and build a computer or build or fly an airplane or build a skyscraper or write an encyclopedia. God has given the animal world the equipment it needs to get along and survive in this world, but to man alone has he given the ability to know truth and gain wisdom. Man alone has an eternal soul. Man alone knows that he has an appointment with death. Hebrews 9:27, and as it is appointed a man once to die, but after this the judgment, man alone knows that one day he will die. Every single one of you in here this morning, though you may not like to think about it, you know that one day you will die. Oh, science will never discover the key to eternal physical life in this world. You'll never find the fountain of youth. You know, even if you're young and in good health this morning, that one day you will die. Every man, every woman has an appointment with death. Just as you may schedule a doctor's appointment for 6 months down the road, and you write it on a calendar, and you may not be looking forward to it, and you may not anticipate going to the doctor, and you're not excited about it, but you know that appointment's coming. And each day brings you one day closer to that appointment with the doctor or that appointment with the dentist. So every person who ever lives has an appointment with death. Oh, there's a date written down on God's calendar when you too must die. Oh, the animal doesn't know that. Animals do not understand that. Job 35:11 tells us that God teaches us more than the beasts of the earth and makes us wiser than the fowls of heaven. Unfortunately, too many men have taken their God-given intelligence and defiled it and used it for that which is not good. They take the mind that God has given them and darken it with foolishness and even deny the very God who made them. And many times, because they've been educated, other people assume that what they say is right. In the book of Job, Elihu makes an astute statement, Job 32:9. He says this, "Great men are not always wise." Oh, how true. Great men are not always wise. Simply because a man has an education does not make him wise. We worship at the shrine of education and information, not realizing that that does not represent wisdom or knowledge. Hey, the phone book contains information. In fact, it's loaded with information, and you could study it, and I could lecture you on it and test you as well, and you will have a lot of information, and you will have received an education, but you will not have gained any wisdom or knowledge. And you can enroll in the leading university of our day and listen to PhDs lecture about evolution, and you may receive an education, but you will not get wisdom. In fact, studying the phone book will be more profitable because at least that information is usually true. When you deny this book, anything you say is suspect. And what the evolutionists discovered 5 years ago, they discover something today that contradicts what they said 5 years ago, and they're constantly changing and constantly updating and correcting and modifying because they don't have the truth. Here's an article. NASA scientists proposed last week that it could not have taken more than 165 million years for the most fundamental forms of life to evolve on Earth, far less time than some had thought. Based on studies of craters on the moon, Vern Oberbeck and his colleagues at the Ames Research Center in Mountain View, California, estimated that objects at least 150 miles in diameter slammed into Earth about every 165 million years. Impacts of that magnitude would have sterilized the surface of the Earth, killing all developing life, he said. That means it could not have taken longer than 165 million years for early chemical evolution to occur on Earth, because any such life would have been destroyed every time one of these objects struck, Oberbeck said. If the new shorter estimate is correct, then the most fundamental forms of life can apparently evolve in less time than had been thought, said planetary scientist Christopher Chiba of Cornell University of Ithaca, New York. If life evolves fast, then maybe it's easy. And if the evolution of life was easy, then there's great hope for it to have happened on other worlds as well, he said. Well, they got one thing right. It was fast and it was easy. Genesis 1 tells us over and over, and God said, and it was so, and God saw that it was good. It was fast and it was easy and it was good. Mark Twain, many years ago, saw through their pseudo-scientific posturings. He made this observation. He said, in the space of 176 years, the lower Mississippi has shortened itself 242 miles. That's true. This is an average of a trifle over a mile and a third per year. Therefore, any calm person who is not blind or idiotic can see that in the Oolitic Silurian period, just over a million years ago, next November, the lower Mississippi was upward of 1,300,000 miles long and stuck out over the Gulf of Mexico like a fishing rod. There is something fascinating about science. One gets such wholesale returns for such a trifling investment of fact. And how many things people just blindly accept because some expert said it. And some expert said it, so we must assume that it's true. They have more education than we do, and so they must be correct. We're told we don't have a tail anymore because we don't need one. Says who? A tail would be handy. You guys would like to read the morning paper and drink coffee? You wouldn't have to put the paper down to sip your coffee. Hang on to your coffee, your tail just comes around, holds a cup of coffee, right? That'd be handy. I can see some use for that. You mothers, a baby in one arm, wash dishes with one hand and dry with your tail. You wouldn't even have to slow down. You could just keep right on going. You could dust, vacuum, and wash windows all at the same time. You mechanics, you construction workers, you guys could use a tail. You wallpaper hangers, hey, they could use a tail. Waitresses, you could use a tail. Think of how many tables you could serve and gather your tips and no one's even watching and keep serving people. Nurses, you could use a tail. Who says we don't need a tail? We need one so badly that even if monkeys didn't have them, we should have evolved them ourselves, if evolution's true. I used to drive a pinto. You ever tried to drive a stick shift while eating a hamburger and fries and drinking a Coke? It isn't easy. I could have used a tail. I finally had to sell my car because I couldn't evolve a tail. It was just too dangerous. We're digressing somewhat here. Consider the archer fish. About a foot in length, when full grown, it can live in salt water or fresh water. It gets its name from its ability to shoot insects off of branches and leaves overhanging the streams in which they live. An adult archer fish can squirt a bug off a branch some 6 feet above the surface of the water, even a little ladybug or a little gnat. The time of shooting the water at an insect, the tip of the mouth barely breaks the surface of the pond or stream, and the eyes are submerged. Water in the gill chambers is driven into the mouth by a sudden, powerful compression of the gill covers. At the same time, the tongue is pressed upwards, converting a groove in the top of the mouth into a tube, which increases the speed of the outgoing stream. The archer fish, with its eyes below the water, must judge distance and take aim at targets above the water. Now, if you take a stick and you place it at an angle in a glass of water, half out and half in, it will appear that the stick is bent, even if it's perfectly straight. This is due to the bending of light rays as they pass from air into water, and it's known as refraction. The archer fish actually then sees its food in a different position from the true one, and yet it still manages to come out and carry out very good sharpshooting. The archer fish must make allowance for refraction in order to hit its target. The eyes that this fish have are large and more highly organized than most fish and give what is called binocular vision. They're forward-facing with a large overlap, thus enabling the fish to focus well and to judge distances very accurately. This is only one of the specializations enabling the archer fish to shoot down insects. I mentioned the shape of the mouth and the tongue and the mechanism for producing a jet stream of water and the necessary behaviors associated with that all combined to give us a very interesting fish. Now, how long would all of that take to evolve? You know, evolutionists talk in millions and billions of years. Thousands and hundreds of years aren't even in their vocabulary. But let's be generous this morning and open-minded and kind. Let's suppose all that we talked about with the archer fish could have evolved in 500 years. Now, if it was necessary for its survival that it be able to shoot insects off of branches, it could not have survived. 500 years is too long. The archer fish would have died out. So let's say it was not necessary to its survival to shoot bugs off branches. There were and are enough insects and streams already for them to eat, so they would not need to shoot bugs off branches to survive. Why then would it ever try to shoot bugs off branches? Its first attempts would have been pitiful and fruitless. And if they were not even necessary, what would have caused it to continue to try? Surely its eyes and the adjustment for refraction and its tongue and the roof of its mouth and specialized gill covers are things that would have taken a considerable concentrated effort over a long period of time. What was the motivation then? If it didn't need it to survive, then its first attempts obviously would have resulted in tremendous failure. If for at least the first 100 years they would have missed and they didn't need the food anyway, how do you explain it? And if the evolutionary adaptations are not so nearly involved as one might assume, how come other fish haven't so evolved as the archer fish have? The evolutionist cannot answer those questions because the evolutionist is a fool. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. God calls him a fool. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God.